There is a halfway mark between the known and unknown. A middle ground or chamber where divine wisdom and truth reside. In this middle chamber, we will explore and expose the ruling paradigms of social engineering, mind control, government conspiracies, and cover-ups. Join us as we navigate the territories and boundaries of natural law and the ancient principles of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Examine and consider alternative energy systems, holistic healing arts, and wild soulful living to train our awareness in a most novel and abstract manner to view reality from an entirely new perspective. Welcome to the Middle Chamber.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, another great episode of the Middle Chamber. I am Frater X, and as always, joined by my wife, Mater X. Hello, Mater X, are you there?
I am here. Good evening, everyone.
Excellent. Today we're talking with Professor James Fetzer, host of the Real Deal with Jim Fetzer podcast, which is Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 5 p.m., I believe, Central Standard Time over at Revere Radio. Also, check out his website, one of his websites, which is assassinationscience.com. And we will welcome Professor Fetzer momentarily. I just wanted to take the opportunity to give out the usual info here. Follow the latest from the Middle Chamber on our Facebook page over at Frater X, first name, Mater X, last name. So Frater X, Mater X. Also, our blogs. Mine is FraterX.blogspot.com. And Mater X is...
MaterX369 at... I'm sorry, it's MaterX369.blogspot.com.
Excellent. And of course, the show site is MiddleChamber, the letters FX.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at TMC369. And as I said, just a moment, we will welcome our extra special guest for this episode's chat. And as usual, speaking of chats, this show's chat room can be found at MiddleChamberChat.chatango.com, or go to our website for the link or the Facebook page for the link. If it's Saturday night right now, after 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, join us and all of the other listeners in the chat room while we review the podcast together and field any questions and comments from the other listeners. It's a really fun time, and we are loving the growing numbers that are returning each week to help us to review these amazing conversations that we're putting up as podcasts. Now, speaking of which, extra special thanks to last week's guest, Master Adept E.A. Coetting from becomealivinggod.com. That was a very interesting conversation about his chapter, The Gods of the Kali Yuga, from his new book, Anthology of Sorcery, Volume 1, which is actually sold out, but look for Volume 2 real soon over at becomealivinggod.com. And you can check out those archived podcasts at the usual spots for the show, like over at Sync Book Radio Network, which is thesyncbook.com. That's the S-Y-N-C. book.com. We're also over at Stitcher Radio Network. Keyword search is The Middle Chamber. The Middle Chamber. All right. Now, listen, you know, I'm...
Actually, Frater, if I may interrupt for just a moment, I did want to make a comment about the Saturday night chats. Anybody who does want to join us, if you come on just a few minutes before, we'll give you the link to the show and we kind of all sync our media players. At 9 o'clock, we all push play and then we kind of are listening to the show as it's broadcast. And so we can all have a running discourse about whatever's being talked about and anything else that comes up. And it's really kind of fun, I think. And so just wanted to let everybody else know that might not know that yet.
Yes, excellent. Good point to make. Sorry, didn't make that distinction. Absolutely. We like to, quote-unquote, sync our players all at 9 p.m. And that way, you know, for the next however long the show is, even if you come in late, you know where you're going to be at. If we start at 9, you can move the player up to the 9:15, 9:20, whatever time. We're still in the conversation, and you can be right with us, and then later on you can go back and catch up on what you missed. But it is. It's really fun, and we're just trying to create another level to the discourse, and this way we can have – in the past when I did live broadcasts, I wasn't able to address all the real-time questions and comments that were coming in through the chat room, so we're trying to figure out a way to do that.
They still had me, though.
And that's why it was great that you were there to be the one that could kind of, be the sort of field the questions as they came rolling in during the conversation, because obviously a person can only pay attention to so much at once. So, this conversation, as I said, we're really excited about basically in the last few weeks, we've been reviewing a lot of material with regards to the work of David McGowan, who will be coming on next week because he had just written a book called Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. But the thing is that he wrote another book years ago that tonight's guest with us, Professor Fetzer, actually interviewed on his radio show. And they, even though they were talking about the new book that David has written, they were talking about this older book called Wagging the Moon Doggy, which you can still find online. It's a web thread on Dave's website. It's easy to find. Just keyword search Wagging the Moon Doggy. It's in several parts. And this is the book related to all the controversy around the Apollo moon missions and whether or not we actually went. And I marvel at this time that we're living in, and it's truly an age of revelations. It really is. Whether we really want to give credit to the apocalyptic prophetic visions of others, there are a startling number of revelations that have come out in the last 5 to 10 years of things where we've gotten total reversals or just found out finally the details. I mean, we found out who Deep Throat was. We have the deathbed confession of Howard Hunt, the CIA agent that his son claims he confessed to being one of the shooters involved in the JFK assassination. So these are just a couple examples, but I do marvel at so many things that we thought we knew about the world we live in and the history leading right up to this very moment, only to find out, to realize we've been misled, that everything that we think we know is wrong about subjects that we think are just a given, civic mythology of our time. And it has been my experience as one who devoured trivia, Guinness Book of World Records, Ripley Believe It or Not, pop culture facts, especially the more bizarre, fringe, and outrageous facts my whole life. Prided myself in knowing these things and knowing bizarre, random facts that other people were just blown away by, but only to realize how little I truly knew about some things that I thought very important things. And, for example, I was a child of the 70s. I was a toddler when the Apollo missions were being broadcast through the cosmos. I may not personally recall any of the perfect takeoffs, nor the supposed 6 pristine set downs on the lunar surface, all with untested rockets, mind you, because there was a design flaw in these rockets, it turns out, where you could only fire them once because they would seize up during firing. This is what we've heard from experts anyway. So the bottom line is that you couldn't test the rockets that were packaged up and shot 250,000 miles away to be used only once in the most crucial moment where it's like life or death, of course we've seen footage of Neil Armstrong not being able to actually land one of these landers in tests, having to eject at the last minute before being killed over and over again. So you got to wonder. But there's also 6 perfect lunar orbit dockings, as well as 7 returns to Earth completely intact. From 1969 to 1972, America won the space race, or so the world thought. And as a young American boy, I too shared the collective dream of space travel. And I know my wife too. We were raised on Star Trek and Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, Space 1999, Doctor Who. I even wrote to NASA several times, all the way through up into my teen years, dreaming about space camp. And I received their little promotional packets that they'd send with the, this is before the internet, so you'd write to NASA back in the 70s and 80s, and they would send you these promotional promotional packets complete with all the glossy 8x11 photos of the lunar missions that they would send you. Also, they'd send you, I received, you know, collectible stamps with depicting the images of various rockets and vehicles and stations, all for space travel. And one of my favorite television shows growing up was The $6 Million Man, The Adventures of Steve Austin, former astronaut turned space agent, secret agent, and top secret weapon, the Bionic Man, you know, all because of a crash in a test vehicle. He was testing a new vehicle, which actually the footage from The $6 Million Man, it turns out, was a real crash that occurred. The pilot actually survived that crash, but they used that for the footage anyway. So the point is that we were all healthily ensconced in this vision of space travel and the Jetsons with the flying cars and tube technology and little pills that turned into whole meals and, you know, all these things that we were taught to believe was the future. And so we're going to explore some of that, and we're going to explore other things too, the memes and paradigms of conspiracies, because our guest tonight is he offers a veritable master's degree course in conspiracy science as far as I'm concerned. And so, and this is just in the research that he's gathered. But, you know, back in 2001, just a few months before 9/11, remember Mater X, as a matter of fact, it was Fox Network broadcast that we watched together called Did We Go to the Moon?
And yes, once I remember that.
Right. We were sitting there. I can remember like it was yesterday. And, you know, and once again, our collective experience, we felt as if the shells had fallen away from our eyes again, like, whoa, what is this? You know, and there were just so many questions that were raised that you couldn't ignore the fantastic possibility. And so in this broadcast, in this podcast today, we are blatantly asking that loaded question, among many others, exploring false flag events throughout more recent American history and going back decades, centuries. I mean, this is an ongoing development. This is not a new experience in our civic history together, especially as Americans, but worldwide, really, I'm sure. You know, I can only speak to America because that's where I'm from. But, you know, the question that's blatantly asked first is, did we send a group of astronauts to the moon and back a 500,000-mile journey 45 years ago, as we are all expected to believe, or was it an elaborate hoax with the many complex reasons possibly involved as to why? Before you allow the shutters to drop over your eyes and ears, everyone, you know, on this one, let us now consider all the facts and questions at the root of this controversy as a model that we can then template, we can then apply to several other controversies, and realize, you know, that there are in fact many unanswered questions that deserve credence. We should be looking at these things again. We should be reviewing. And in our world, in our culture today, we're taught and we're conditioned not to review, to not create the context which needs to be created with all of these issues in order to understand the bigger picture of just exactly what's going on in our lives. And so tonight, we're going to review first the root of this one big question, this one big possible host. And our guest's website, which is, as I said, assassinationscience.com, in the left-hand column, you'll find several links. And so we're going to explore some of these, and to help us unpack the mountain of controversial material which has grown up around this and so many other questions is none other than our good friend here at the show. I actually met Jim Fetzer a couple times last year at a couple different conferences. And Professor James H. Fetzer is, in fact, let me just let everybody know, in case you're not familiar, I find it hard to believe, but he's a former Marine Corps officer. He was published widely on theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He's also conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, the events of 9/11, the plane crash that killed Senator Paul Wellstone, among many powerful sociocultural events in our time. He's also the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and other books by him include The Evolution of Intelligence, The 9/11 Conspiracy, Render Unto Darwin, and The Place of Probability in Science. So once again, he also, as I said, has a he's a host of his own podcast called The Real Deal with Jim Fetzer, which you can check it out. And you can check out the blog, radiofetzer.blogspot.com, for more information. And we will be reviewing his information, especially some of the research around the work of David McGowan, as we said, will be coming on next week. His book, Wagging the Moon Doggy, was brought up in a conversation with Jim Fetzer and David McGowan, which sort of inspired me to reach out to Jim, and I remembered that he, too, had much to say on this and so many other subjects. So now, dear listeners, join us in welcoming the one and only Professor James H. Fetzer into the middle chamber. Greetings, Jim. How are you?
Just fine, Frater Matter. I'm very glad to be back with you again.
Well, thank you so much for making time for us today to discuss this and many other highly relevant topics, but especially the possibility that NASA faked the Apollo missions. Now, considering your primary among contenders out there, I think, revealing a lot of powerful truths and raising so much controversy in civic mythologies that we are conditioned to just accept wholesale today, which are clearly co-opted and employed as tools for social control by mine and my know my wife's estimation, we wanted to bring you into this conversation and we're having, reviewing the data and the startling claims made out there with regards to whether we actually went to the moon 45 years ago or ever. And your collective body of work, we thought, offers what amounts to, as I said, a master's degree in a program in conspiracy sciences. So
maybe even a PhD, Frater.
Exactly. So what I wanted to do was just kind of throw the ball in your court here. And drew you first to the controversy surrounding the NASA Apollo mission programs?
Well, let me make a couple observations about your introduction, because you covered a lot of territory. You mentioned Deep Throat, for example, and it's my conviction that it was not this FBI agent by the name of Mark Felt, but actually Deep Throat. And think of how well the name fits. Henry Kissinger, who spent all this time with Nixon praying together and a host of other issues. Kissinger is an individual who had the gravitas, the inside knowledge and so forth to play the role attributed to them by Bernstein and Woodward in The President's Men, which, of course, was an expose of the Watergate scandal. And may I say that we have a new development now, actually an article that I have just published about Sandy Hook, because Wolfgang Halbig, who is the Florida State Trooper, former school principal and nationally recognized school safety expert, who has been spearheading the effort to figure out what happened at Sandy Hook, has had confirmation from two Connecticut state police officers that an 11,000-page document in his position was actually the script for the Sandy Hook hoax. And it's really quite fascinating. I have published so much about Sandy Hook now, where those who want to catch up can go to my article archive at Veterans Today, veteranstoday.com/author/Fetzer/ will get you there and just start working backwards. But this latest is really the smoking gun. And just to, you know, make one or two points about it, it turns out the script included sworn affidavits from a dozen and a half Connecticut state police officers that were clearly false, talking about entering the school through the broken window at the front. This, of course, is alleged to have been caused by Adam Lanza in making his entry into the building. But I've discovered footage of the window, and the hole is a little too high and a little too small for anyone to have entered into it through it, much less a 6-foot-tall Adam Lanza with a couple of handguns and an assault rifle and the equipment. I mean, it's just a ridiculous story. And what we find is that the official crime scene photographs show the hole much enlarged. Even then, as Wolfgang observes, although these troopers sign affidavits claiming they entered through that opening, it would not have been appropriate for trained law enforcement officials to have done that. They would use their metal batons to clean out the whole window so they wouldn't get cut or their clothing torn by passing through the window. And not only do we have the fanciful story, but we have further corroboration in that the glass, the shattered glass inside, has not been crunched and pulverized by the repeated tramping of boots from all of these troopers. And the point I make in relation to what I have just observed about Deep Throat is it seems to me this scandal is bigger than Watergate. It goes from Barack Obama to Eric Holder to Governor Malloy of the state, the lieutenant governor, the Connecticut State Police Force, the Newtown Police Force, the Sandy Hook, the school board for Newtown School. I mean, this is huge, and it's really very consistent with the observation that Dave McGowan makes in Wagging the Moon Doggy, where he's talking about Hitler's minister of propaganda and how they were convinced that if you're going to lie to the people, make it a really big lie. In part, it's because ordinary folks are used to making little lies, but have, you know, it's almost inconceivable for them to make big lies. This was a big lie. It involved a whole lot of people for a whole lot of reasons. The whole thing was an elaborate fraud and a hoax. And we now have the evidence that exposes a big lie by the American government. The local Connecticut authorities have been going all out to try to cover it up. For example, the governor just gave awards to about 50 different individuals who were involved in coping with issues as first responders or in other roles that day. But it's all complete showbiz. I mean, this is just a PR effort. And it's terribly, terribly embarrassing. I believe the illusion has finally been removed in that instance. Now, with regard to E. Howard Hunt, you mentioned his son, St. John, who shared with us E. Howard Hunt's final confessions. For those who are unaware, E. Howard Hunt was very deep inside the CIA. He was a very imaginative guy. He published a couple of dozen books about, you know, spy thrillers and so forth, but many of them appear to have been based on plots that he actually was involved in executing. And what's crucial about what E. Howard told his son, St. John, which was published in Rolling Stone under the title The Last Confessions of E. Howard Hunt, was that the chain of command for the execution of John F. Kennedy went from Lyndon Baines Johnson to Cord Meyer, who was then in charge of covert affairs for the CIA, to Phillips, David Attlee Phillips, who was CIA in charge of Western Hemisphere, to William Harvey, who was a head of assassinations, to David Sanchez Morales, and on down to others. I've actually identified shooters at six different locations who seem to represent different organizations that were involved in taking JFK out, including the Dallas Sheriff's Office, the Dallas Police Department, an Air Force expert, a CIA mafia guy, Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman, and an anti-Castro Cuban, where we could go into their motives and all that, and I could, in excruciating detail, explain what we now know as to what happened there. But what's most important in tying all these together, where the Woodward and Bernstein is a striking case of investigative journalists having performed their duty, because in both relation to JFK and in relation to the moon landing, it's very obvious that did not happen. Whereas David McGowan, again, observes, it was the perfect time, really, to use television as the vehicle or the medium for creating this, conveying this false story. Television was kind of grainy. They used a single feed. It was not very clear footage. They obviously had a script, and you know, it was just an ideal set of circumstances for using that medium to propagate a fantasy about man going to the moon. I mentioned three resources, Dave McGowan obviously being one. Winston Wu is another. He has got a wonderful conspiracy trilogy page where he talks about the moon landing and JFK, and I encourage everyone to check that out. And also Jack White, who was a legendary student of photo and films in relation to JFK. He and I also collaborated in relation to research on 9/11, but Jack has done a did a huge amount of research on the moon landing photographs, discovering, you know, anomaly after anomaly. You had shadows pointing in more than one direction when presumably on the moon there's only one source of light, namely the sun. You had moon rovers in a position where there were no tracks leading to its location either before or after, where it apparently had been put into position using a crane. The reflections where reflections shouldn't be, illumination where illumination should not be, one after another. And I just say, you know, these three resources, it seems to me, constitute a massive repository of information and evidence that the moon landing was a fraud. Whereas Winston Wu has observed, if we can't go to the moon today, it certainly wasn't possible for us to have gone to the moon in 1969, which is an impeccable point. And the politics of the circumstance where the Russians had launched Sputnik and made it appear as though America was behind in the space race called for some desperate measures. And the whole moon landing hoax, which appears to have been done in collaboration with Stanley Kubrick, who is just finishing, it appears, his masterpiece, Space Odyssey 2001, where they actually use the sets and the technological expertise he had acquired in developing the film for the purpose of faking the moon landing images.
Wow, what a response. But, you know, let's just cover some of the things that the comments you made. First of all, I really like the way you bring out these current events, like with the Sandy Hook incident. These things are relevant, everyone, because they imply the brazen will to deceive in the media and our government officials. That this is real-time evidence of an event, a false flag event, a media event, which is obviously filled with deception. And the other one would be the Boston bombing, which is another one you cover, which is a real-time current event. And then you just work your way backwards, as you said, to people who go to the website. You work your way backwards through the last 10 years, 20 years, half a century. You find one after another examples of this. And the fact you mentioned E. Howard Hunt, yeah, I remember we had a book at one point. We came across a little paperback that was written by him. It was like an occult spy thriller set in D.C., written in like the 70s by E. Howard Hunt, which I thought was remarkable considering just what we know about MKUltra, mind control, and occult, you know, all the things that they utilize as means and tools to, you know, just step up the deception in that area. But you also, you know, one of the evidence that you're rattling off the different points about the photographic evidence, there's also the absence of the blast crater underneath this thrusting rocket that we're supposed to believe slowly lowered itself down with thousands of pounds of thrust on a pristine lunar surface, and yet the final touchdown, we have a shot of a capsule, looks like it's been lowered into place with not a speck of dust on it and not any kind of blast crater beneath it like anyone would imagine, just from pure, whether it's lunar or Earth physics.
Very, very nice point, Fratter, because, you know, there would have been enormous disbursement of dust beneath any such crater. And also when, of course, the moon lander takes off, it's being pulled up in a way as though by a pulley. And actually, you can see wires in some cases. I mean, it's really shocking when you get deeply into it how amateurishly it was done, although I do believe that those who created the deception never thought that it would be subjected to such intense critical scrutiny. And of course, to evade detection, NASA now claims it lost its original moon footage, which of course is preposterous on its face. I mean, this has to be the most, if it were authentic, the most precious footage ever acquired by the hand of man. I mean, it actually could be argued to outweigh the Zapruder and home movie footage of the assassination of JFK, which, by the way, we've been able to prove has been massively edited and revised using the sophisticated techniques of optical printing and special effects, in part because it was too revealing. The driver of the presidential limousine, William Greer, actually pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt after bullets had begun to be fired to make sure JFK would be killed. During that interval, he was shot twice in the head, once from behind from the Dal Tex, fired by an anti-Castro Cuban, hit him in the back of the head. He slumped forward. Jackie eased him up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit the right temple by shot fired from the north end of the Triple Underpass by a CIA mafia guy by the name of Frank Sturgis. The anti-Castro Cuban, by the way, was his name is Nestor Tony Escadro. And that shot fired by Sturgis was a frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium to the left rear with so much force that when they impacted with a motorcycle patrolman riding there, Bobby Hargis, he initially thought he himself had been shot. I calculate now, given all that transpired, including Clint Hill rushing forward, getting up on the back of the limo, pushing Jackie back down in the seat, laying across the back seat, peering into this fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head, turning and giving his colleagues a thumb down, all of which transpired before the limousine had reached the Triple Underpass, and where even Roy Kellerman, who was in charge of the presidential limo sitting in the passenger seat, told the Warren Commission that he had looked back and seen Clint Hill lying across the trunk. He was actually lying across the back seat, but from Kellerman's perspective, it would have looked like the trunk. And if you can believe this, new research by a brilliant student of JFK by the name of Larry Rivera about the four motorcycle escort officers, including tape recordings of them that were made not long after the assassination by Fred Newcomb, who was one of the best of the early students of the assassination, revealed that Hargis actually set his motorcycle down and walked across the street in between the limousine, which tells you how long they had to be stationary or motionless. I mean, this is really incredible stuff. Most of the world is unaware of it, has never really pondered that what is often touted as the closest thing to absolute truth we have about the assassination, namely the Zapruder film, could have been fake. But it's not a large jump from, you know, taking real footage and recreating it to give a false depiction of the sequence of events in Dealey Plaza to creating film footage on a movie set and then broadcasting it by a single channel over television to convince the world that man had actually landed on the moon. Both of them were faked, albeit in different ways, but it's terribly important to appreciate the role of the media in all of this, because in particular in relation to JFK, the media has been absolutely incompetent or more likely suppressed in its coverage, where we now know from William Colby, the former director of the CIA, that the agency owns everyone of significance in the major media, and where Carl Bernstein, the same Carl Bernstein who wrote All the President's Men with Bob Woodward, published an article in Rolling Stone in 1977 entitled The CIA and the Media, in which he revealed that his conversations with high-ranking officials of the agency led to their boasting that their greatest successes have been with Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS. And I can assure you, in that era, if you controlled the news coming from Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS, you had a lock on the media. The major developer of propaganda techniques for the CIA, named Frank Wisner, spoke of what he called the mighty Wurlitzer, which really was his control over the radio, television, newspapers, so that he could have a story and all of them would be playing to his tune as the mighty Wurlitzer to get out the propaganda every nook and cranny of the country. So this is what we've been up against. And it's hardly surprising that in a case like, say, for example, Sandy Hook, it would be so difficult ultimately to crack the case, although there have been many, many indications before now. And whereas you mentioned with the Boston bombing, one of the latest, the key to understanding the case is the medical evidence, because you have this fellow who seems to have had his legs blown off below the knees, but he's not spurting blood. He doesn't appear to be in anguishing in pain. There's a fellow in a hood beside him who's helping to attach a false prosthesis with a phony bone extension, apparently to make it look more horrifying. There's no blood on the scene initially. Then it starts showing up, only it's fake blood rather than real blood. And we even have footage showing the little containers from which it was spurted out to create this phony impression. Then he was put in a wheelchair and rushed away, where a fellow in a cowboy hat who had been standing by waiting for his cue to enter the scene, following the script, is running along beside him with a loosely tied bandage that's supposed to simulate a tourniquet, but it's not tied tightly enough to do any good. I mean, the last thing you would do, had this been a real casualty of a real damage to his legs of that kind, would have been to put him in a wheelchair. You want to keep him prone. With injuries like that, you, from the bleeding out, you're unconscious in a minute, dead in two. Putting him upright means gravity helps to flow of blood, but when he's put in the wheelchair, and this fellow in the cowboy hat is running along beside him holding a piece of cloth as though it were a tourniquet, but which isn't functioning as a tourniquet. We now know from Nathan Foulkes, F-O-L-K-S, who's a Hollywood producer and director, that man was an actor whom Nathan Foulkes had himself actually cast in one of his films, and he discerned immediately that what we were being shown was what's called hyper-realistic filming, where they create a scene as realistic as possible to train, for example, soldiers who've never been into combat, so they'll be able to prepare them emotionally and psychologically for what they may encounter. So I think even the Boston bombing has been blown sky high here, along with Sandy Hook, and where the American people have to become sophisticated enough to recognize that they're being manipulated by the media. In fact, one of the points I make in this latest article about Sandy Hook is that since terrorism entails instilling fear into a population in order to make it more manageable, in order to promote a political agenda, what we have been exposed to in both the Boston bombing and Sandy Hook are acts of terrorism. I mean, the Sandy Hook thing, the alleged shooting of 20 children and 6 adults just struck terror into the hearts and minds of every parent across the entire country. This is disgraceful conduct, isn't it? Isn't it, Mater? Completely disgraceful.
Yeah, it really is. Could you comment maybe on... I've seen a couple of things posted on various social media sites that had pictures of like the same people at these events. Like this same woman appeared at Sandy Hook and also at the Boston bombing. And then another girl had been on the phone looking very distraught. And I think it was maybe at the Boston bombing, and it could have been at something else in recent history, but she was also at Sandy Hook or one of the other ones that had happened right before then.
Let me just say that I think that the kind of evidence you're talking about, and I've seen quite a lot of it, looks very plausible to me. What has to be understood is that these agencies have become so blatant, they actually advertise for crisis actors to participate in these events. There was a recent advertisement for in Atlanta, another for in Houston, and it is to me completely would be completely unsurprising if many of the same people were to go from one event to another event to pick up their paycheck for performing the role of a victim. In fact, we have a drill going on, I think, right here in Madison today, and in the newspaper it was talking about how they were going to set off an explosion. I think this is in the vicinity of Randall Stadium, which is the football stadium where the Badgers play their home games. They warning the neighbors not to be worried about the explosion, but they also were talking about how there were going to be persons there who were going to be bandaged and appear to have wounds to play the role of victims. So that's even going right here in Madison, Wisconsin. I just say, they become so open and obvious about all this stuff, and there's no question whatsoever anymore that both Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing were actually drills that were designed, in the case of the Sandy Hook, to undermine the Second Amendment. It turns out Eric Holder has been a fanatic in support of gun control, where in one of my recent articles, my pick of the top 10 articles, videos, interviews. I begin with a clip of Eric Holder addressing a National Democratic Women's Conference in Washington, D.C. in 1995, and where he's talking about how important it is to change the public's attitude about guns. And he uses the word brainwashing. He says we're going to have to brainwash them to change their attitude about guns.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And even the day of the Boston bombing, Barack Obama came out and was expressing disgust that the Congress hadn't passed the very severe, the very stringent gun control legislation. He was more upset about that than he was with the alleged event that had just taken place in Boston, which I think is further revealing, where the Boston event clearly was intended to undermine our Fourth Amendment right and to subvert belief in the Posse Comitatus, which, of course, is a statute from 1878 that precludes the use of military force to perform police function. They were going door to door, soldiers in uniform with weapons, to evicting citizens from their own homes with no warrant, with no justification, all in pursuit of a single 19-year-old young man who allegedly had something to do with it, but where, you know, all the evidence points in another direction. In fact, the alternative media were completely brilliant that day, because by the evening of the Boston bombing, they'd already zoomed in on the actual perps, who were these Kraft International personnel wearing khaki trousers, black jackets, and black baseball caps, with Chavez skull cap insignia, and where the motto of Kraft is violence does solve problems. And we have photographs of the two of these guys in the vicinity of where one of the backpacks exploded. He's wearing a black backpack with a white square on it. The backpack that explodes is a black backpack with a white square, and he's rushing away subsequently minus the backpack with a white square. I mean, it can't get much more obvious than this. And then,
right.
And of course, with so much scrutiny being directed to all the photographs, that the FBI actually sent out a stooge 4 days later on Thursday to say, don't look at the man behind the curtain, don't look at any photographs at all, just look at these two, and presented photographs of the two brothers and said, we need your help in identifying them. When Mater, would you believe it, turned out that the FBI already knew their identity. They'd had them under surveillance for at least the last 5 years. I mean, this is how blatant it's got in the United States today.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that at all.
We lived in Boston for years. We met in Boston, as a matter of fact, Jim. And I grew up on Cape Cod, South Shore, just an hour and a half away from Boston. And we were out there during that. My sister lives in Boston, and they all stayed home from work that day. And it was so repugnant to me, these slogans of Boston Strong and stuff that came out right afterwards, because to me, it's represented such a level of submission by the place where the Boston Tea Party, the birth of the revolution in America, Boston, and everybody just did exactly what they were told and cowered behind their curtains while the military, as you said, preened and rode up and down in the streets like some bizarre, you know, Russian display of armament or something from the Cold War, you know, and like it was just it was like a celebrated by the media like some great achievement.
You're right on it, Fred. I had a girlfriend when I was working on my PhD finishing, and she came to begin her research, who was from Boston, from Chelsea. And I actually spent 7 Christmases in a row in Boston with her. This was the late 60s, early 70s. So I developed a great affection for Boston. And of course, I'm a huge fan of JFK. My younger brother lives on Cape Cod. They have a place in Hyannis, not far from Hyannis Port. So when I visited them, we have walked down the street, less than a mile away to the Kennedy compound there in Hyannis Port. So
I was born literally down the road from the Hyannis compound at Cape Cod Hospital.
Wonderful. Wonderful. My brother has had health problems, and he has been in the same hospital where you were born.
Yeah, and my family moved to Cape Cod in 1690, so that's been
wonderful.
There for
that's
a
wonderful.
Long time.
That's
you know,
wonderful. Yeah,
but,
I love
but
it.
this is, you know, what we're talking about is really, it's all related because it goes back. I mean, bringing up the, it's so relevant. We're talking about Kennedy. He was the mouthpiece of the generation at the time, aspiring to this great vision of us to achieve, you know, beating the Russians into space, beating them to the moon. We obviously didn't beat them into space, but we were trying to beat them to the moon. And that mentality of American exceptionalism that is somehow been twisted and contorted into what this present day, like I already mentioned, this brazen will to deceive the general public. You know, you mentioned these actors and these crisis actors that are involved in these incidents, and when we reviewed the McGowan material, he mentioned Lookout Mountain Laboratory started in the late 40s in right above Laurel Canyon, where they produced 15,000 classified films for the government and intelligence agencies. What does everyone think those films were all about? Just how-to films and public service announcements? I don't think so. I think that a lot of those were the very foundations of the civic mythology. As you said, the medium of television, radio, movies together was the most powerful tool of social control. And moving forward into our present day and age, I mean, you know, obviously the unintended consequence of us all having access to the computer-generated programs that can show where things have been overlaid and superimposed, and to be able to slow things down and to really scrutinize the remaining evidence, you know, as long as it's not erased like the 700 boxes of footage that NASA erased of the original lunar landing, you know, putting that aside for a moment. All they've done now, though, and I'm sure you could speak to this, Jim, is created this cult of debunker, this mentality of, you know, well, it began a long time ago with the existentialists, I think, telling us there is no truth. You can never really, you know, convincing everyone that there is no absolute truths leads to the being able to question and dismiss even the most blatant evidence when it's being presented, right?
Well, yes, there's a great deal to what you are saying, including, for example, that we have telescopes that are amply powerful enough that they ought to be able to detect any remnants of American presence on the moon. Most importantly, a point that Dave McGowan, but they haven't done that. And, you know, there was a recent announcement that the Chinese were going to orbit the moon and see if they couldn't pick up, you know, detect the American flag there and all that. But then it went silent. Apparently, the American government made some pitch or appeal. But I think Dave McGowan has made the most important point about the space program, that from its inception, it's been an elaborate cover for the research, development, and deployment of space-based weapons and surveillance systems. I think that is actually the key to understanding what's been going on here, where, sending man to the moon, you know, as a hoax was just a way of giving a justification for the expenditure of vast sums of money, which were actually intended to be used for weapon systems. There was a fellow by the name of Bob Bauman. He'd been an Air Force pilot in Korea, had 101 kills, and was involved in 9/11 research. And when I interviewed him on my radio show at one point in time, he'd been the scientific director of the Star Wars program under two presidents. And I asked him about it, whether it wasn't the case that this had always been offensive rather than defensive. And while he demurred on my show, within a couple of weeks, he was making that very point in other interviews he was given, namely that the Star Wars program was always to develop offensive weapons. It was never intended purely defensive, even though that was the way it was sold to the public.
Yeah, you know, let's create a little. This is something that I think was so remarkable when reviewing the McGowan, a timeline that he created in Wagging the Moon Doggy, that I wanted to kind of put out to the listeners who might not be aware of, just consider this, everyone. The time period we're talking about, let's start with May 1969. Now, just a few months into his term, Nixon and Henry Kissinger, who you mentioned earlier as possibly being Deep Throat, and yeah, what a pun, right, considering his voice. But these guys were exposed by the press as illegally carpet bombing Cambodia. And then in June, right after that, Nixon announces the Vietnamization of the war, where they're going to supposedly start withdrawing troops in 1969, everybody, when in fact only about 25,000 troops were part of that process of the 540,000 troops that were still there. So really a negligible decrease in troops. So what happens? On July 14th of that same year, the month later, Francis Riedemeyer was granted conscientious objector status after exposing his training in assassinations and torture with the Phoenix program, which was a CIA program, government funded. Okay, so that's a huge, huge controversial backlash, you know, in the media. And what happens? 2 days later, Apollo 11 blasts off into space. 4 days after that, the Eagle supposedly lands. And then, you know, we move forward. Everyone's distracted. 4 months later, the massacre at My Lai happens. 504 civilians are murdered by a squad of soldiers led by one Lieutenant Calley. It's exposed by Seymour Hersh. That same month, Apollo 12 launches and lands on the moon. Then April 11th through the 17th of 1970, the Apollo 13 disaster. Well, it just so happens that during that disaster on April 14th, three Vietnam vets hold a multi-city press conference around the world, New York, San Francisco, and Rome, publicizing the same ongoing Phoenix program sponsored by the CIA, in which they personally participated and have firsthand knowledge, and no one pays attention. No one even cares because everybody's worried about the astronauts and the Apollo 13 capsule.
Prater, those are brilliant points. And in fact, the mastermind between Operation Phoenix appears to have been an Air Force general by the name of Edward Lansdale, who was actually photographed in Dealey Plaza walking past the three tramps, a gross impropriety. He was identified by no less authorities than L. Fletcher Prouty, who was a liaison between the CIA and the Pentagon and the White House for covert activities, and Victor Krulak, among the most celebrated of Marine Corps generals. We have other photographs of George H.W. Bush standing in front of the book depository, and yet a third photograph where Lansdale is waiting to speak to Bush. I hate to disillusion anyone here, but George Herbert Walker Bush appears to have supervised a JFK hit team, that very hit team that was in the Dow Tech. You can find an article about it in Veterans Today. Did George H.W. Bush coordinate a JFK hit team by Richard Hook, who along with Larry Rivera is another of a generation of completely brilliant students of JFK? And where, you know, what we have is a growing body of evidence that the whole point of taking out JFK was to reverse all of the policies of JFK and replace him with those of Lyndon Johnson, including his decision to pull our forces out of Vietnam. He had antagonized the Joint Chiefs because he had refused to invade Cuba against their unanimous recommendation. He'd signed an above-ground disband treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to the unanimous opposition. Now he's pulling our forces out of Cuba. He was threatening to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. The anti-Castro Cubans thought he had betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs, though that was largely a myth that was promoted by the CIA for their own benefit, and a host of other factors. But the key is that Edward Lansdale, who appears to have been involved in Operation Phoenix, also appears to have been the person who supervised and organized the location of the shooters for the execution of the 35th President of the United States.
And also, wasn't JFK meeting secretly with Nikita Khrushchev through the Pope, Pius, at the time?
Well, they had back-channel communications because neither of them could trust their militaries, who were both very, very hawkish, and they were trying to bring about world peace. Actually, and JFK also wanted to normalize relations with Cuba. In fact, there was a representative of JFK and of Fidel Castro meeting in Paris the day of the assassination. Now, it appears that James Jesus Angleton, the legendary counter-espionage official at the CIA, discovered that Khrushchev and Kennedy had been having the secret correspondence and appears to have shared that information with others to create the impression, false though it was, that he was betraying the United States and was a traitor to the country. It is also the case that James Jesus Angleton appears to have had very close ties with Israel, and that Jack was at loggerheads with David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, and a principal in the founder of the nation, because Ben-Gurion wanted to develop nuclear weapons, which JFK opposed. He did not want to see a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. After his assassination, of course, Lyndon reverted to building up our troops in the Middle East. The CIA went on its way. Israel developed its nuclear weapons. The prosecution, the mafia disappeared. The oil depletion allowance, the Texas oil men feared he was going to cut, was left intact. I mean, in the Fed, JFK, this is really striking in retrospect. JFK had actually instructed the Department of the Treasury to print hundreds of millions of dollars of United States notes on the ground that it was absurd for the American government to pay interest to a consortium of private banks to publish the currency of the United States. It was very threatening to the Eastern establishment and the powerful interests surrounding the Fed, which Jack, it's very evident, was going to abolish or at least massively reform. I think he actually was going to get rid of it altogether. This is basically a printing press that enables these Eastern bankers to print all the money they want with absolutely nothing to justify it. It's called fiat currency. And what has propped it up, you know, it was Nixon who took the dollar off of the gold standard, where it had been supported, at least in principle, by a stockpile of gold in Fort Knox, which most students believe today is actually bereft of any contents today. I mean, there have been lead bars that are coated with gold that have been used to replace gold bars in many contexts. And where, you know, it was kept maintained as an international currency for oil transactions known as a petrodollar. And it was after Saddam Hussein, you know, dropped the petrodollar. Muammar Gaddafi introduced the gold dinar, which would have become the currency of all of Africa. Iran went to an oil bourse where they were trading for oil in any kind of currency. That brought them into the sights of the American military. I mean, it's really, we've been ruthless for countries that have abandoned the petrodollar. But today, it's becoming ubiquitous around the world. Russia is trading for gas in no longer in petrodollars. And, of course, the emergence of the BRICS countries as an alternative to the World Bank, Brazil and India and China and Russia and South Africa are being joined by many other countries in South America, where Vladimir Putin just made a triumphal visit there. He was feted by every leader of the Latin American and South American countries. And it's very obvious that America has lost its standing in the world. And with the demise of the petrodollar, the reverberations for the United States financially are going to be simply titanic.
Yeah. Wow. Can you imagine what the world would be like right now? I mean, if somebody had gotten wind of this conspiracy, because I do personally believe that they killed Kennedy. I mean, I don't think that I don't buy the party line here at all. And I don't think that I could put it past anybody that's involved in something like that to do even more things. And I just wonder where we would be, you know, as a society, as a planet, really, because I mean, if he was sitting, you know, having private conversations with Khrushchev, I mean, maybe they were talking peace, you know, maybe they were talking cooperation, you know, and I mean, just think of where we might be now.
Bader, you're absolutely right. 100% right. There's a wonderful book by a fellow named James Douglas with two S's entitled JFK and the Unspeakable, where he talks about all these powerful special interests that JFK antagonized once he got into office and how much he had evolved from a more or less traditional cold warrior into a statesman for peace. He was not only, you know, affected by his own growth and development, but also by the influence of a woman by the name of Mary Meyer, who happened to be the ex-wife of Cord Meyer. You may have heard me mention that E. Howard Hunt had identified the chain of command for the assassination going from Lyndon Johnson to Cord Meyer to David Attlee Phillips and so forth. Well, JFK and Cord Meyer had known each other growing up, and he had known Mary, and they had had a very powerful relationship. I think probably the single most significant relationship JFK had with a woman. He was, of course, a notorious womanizer. He wasn't much of a lover. Angie Dickinson said that the greatest experience of her life was her 15 seconds with Jack Kennedy. But the fact of the matter is, with Mary Meyer, he had a very profound relationship, and there's a book about it entitled Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney, who, believe this or not, grew up as a child knowing Mary Meyer, sat in his lap. His father, Wister, was with the CIA. And after her death, as he grew to maturity, he began investigating what had happened to her and discovered that her assassination, her death, was not an accident or a random killing. There was an attempt to blame it on a black man who just happened to be near the walking path where she had been taken out. It was a classic textbook CIA assassination. Virtually everyone in the area was working for the agency. They had a vehicle that they used as a prop to call in a tow truck driver, so he would look over and see someone who resembled the person they were going to frame by the body, except he wasn't dressed properly. This person was wearing a hat and a jacket, but the man they were going to frame had actually fallen asleep on a rock after a tryst with a girlfriend, and when he awakened unexpectedly, he fell in the lake, and he lost his cap and his coat. So that, in fact, when the police arrived to arrest him, he was, all wet and lacking his coat and his cap. But the individual they used to impersonate him at the body, when they lured the tow truck driver there to be an innocent witness, was wearing both the hat and the coat. So that they had a brilliant attorney who, brought out all the inconsistencies in the evidence and got him off. But, I mean, not only did Peter Janney discover that the death of Mary Meyer had been a textbook CIA assassination, but that his own father had been involved not only in the death of Mary, but in the death of JFK. It's quite a stunning book, and it's beautifully written. It's, in my opinion, one of the handful of most important books that have been published about the assassination in the last 10 years.
And this What was the name of that again, Jim?
Mary's Mosaic. Mosaic, Peter Janney, Janney. I could get you a link if you wanted to get him on. He'd be a great interview.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. You mentioned James Douglas, right?
Yeah.
He was, this is a crazy, crazy little sink. When we were living on Cape Cod for the last few years, I was working at this coffee shop, and one of our regular customers was this regular old guy. It was a fishing village or whatever, and he built boats and whatnot. But I mentioned the show to him because Frater had, been doing it already for about a year or so. And he had suggested to me that we talk to his brother, who had written a book about JFK. And I forgot about this until you just mentioned it, because the last name, it clicked on it, because he made mention to tell me that the last name Douglas had two S's.
Yeah.
And so this is just really crazy that now you're bringing that book up in our discussion, and I just felt it was like a really crazy
book. He'd be another great interview for you, as well as this fellow Roger Stone, who's very interesting because he's a right-wing political operative. He did a lot to get Bush into office in Florida and all that, but he's come up with a new book about the man who killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. It's very good. I mean, he doesn't have everything just right, but it's certainly right-headed, and he would be another terrific interview. I can send you contact information on all three of them.
Oh, yeah, we would really appreciate that.
That'd be great, yeah.
That would be excellent, yeah. And so, again, like we said at the beginning of this conversation, everyone, it's this is like the Matrix download of a PhD's crash course in conspiracy sciences.
This is a graduate seminar, yeah.
This is a graduate seminar, yeah, exactly. And, But just to address some of the points you made, you mentioned earlier about the tampering of the Zapruder film with the JFK assassination. And one of the things that became very clear to me early on investigating all the evidence and the different various books and studies and reports that are out there with regards to this assassination, one of the things that was so clear to me right away was all the opportunities for tampering with the film right away. It went off to different places where where obviously agency operatives could have been in place to do work on that film before it got back even to Zapruder. And then, of course, it was put into, what, Time Life Vault for, you know, a decade or so before it was even brought forth.
The key to understanding the chain of custody of this, and there's some who have argued the chain of custody was so tight it didn't allow the film to be altered, is some of those involved in the chain of custody were those who were involved in having it altered. So, I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. Actually, when we talk about reporters, we shouldn't omit Dan Rather's role here on Saturday, where he was among a small group who were allowed to view the film, which appears to have been, you know, it was still the original. It hadn't, the altered version hadn't been created. And he came out from watching and reported to a national public that JFK had fallen forward. Of course, when the film was eventually made available in 1975, when Robert Grodin and Dick Gregory got it onto Geraldo Rivera's show, you saw this violent back and to the left. But the fact of the matter is that violent back and to the left was a creation of the editing of the artifact, because the two hits I described, they merged the two hits. So you had this hit in the back of the head and he slumps forward. Well, they only left one frame where you're moving backward, forward, but it's still there. And then they took out too many frames of after he was hit in the right temple, he slumped to the left. But they took out so many frames that it turned out to be a violent back and to the left. No less an authority than Richard Feynman, this Nobel Prize-winning physicist from Caltech, determined that the two-hit phenomenon, even remaining in the altered film, when David Lifton, who was working on what would become a completely brilliant book about the assassination entitled Best Evidence, went to visit him with his concerns about it, and Feynman did some measurements on the blow-up of these frames, 312, 313, 14, 15, and so forth, and detected the double hit. Interestingly, the best study in print of the double hit phenomenon was in a book by Josiah Thompson entitled 6 Seconds in Dallas, which, when I returned from the Far East, where I had been serving as a fire direction officer of a mortar battery, and I was assigned to be a series commander at the recruit depot in San Diego, where I took 300 recruits and 15 DIs through the training cycle, I picked up a copy of his book, and you know, I annotated it, and I found it fascinating because he had been a professor of philosophy. That, of course, was my background too, and I would go on to spend 35 years offering courses in philosophy, especially logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning after I earned my PhD in 1970. But in that book, he has a wonderful diagram, very, very precise, about the motion of JFK's head. And it actually clearly supports the double hit theory, which Richard Feynman independently discovered. But Thompson, oddly enough, turns out to be a guy who's trying to cover the authenticity of the Zapruder film. He's trying to conceal that it was altered. And there's so many proofs that it was altered that he and I have, ever since I organized the first symposium on Zapruder film fakery at a national conference in Dallas in 1996, he has relentlessly attacked me. I have published 3 collections of expert studies on the Assassination Science 1998, Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax 2003, and to this day, he insists that there was no opportunity for the film to be altered, when we know, and this was, we had already figured it out, but it was confirmed actually by the senior analyst for military records for the Assassination Records Review Board, which was created by an act of Congress in the wake of the resurgence of interest in the case generated by Oliver Stone's film JFK. His name is Doug Horn. He has published a 5-volume work in volume 4 of the 5 volumes. He talks about how the film, the original, was taken to the National Photographic Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, the 23rd, that it was an 8mm already split film that had been developed in Dallas, that they didn't have an 8mm projector, so they had to get a store owner up and out to open his shop so they could purchase one in order to view it. But then on Sunday, the replacement was brought. It was a 16mm unsplit film, because the way this 8mm works, you take a 16mm section of film and you shoot up one side, they take it out, flip it over, shoot the other, sort of put it together as a continuous strip. You have to split the film and then splice it together. The 16mm was brought down on Sunday by a fellow who identified himself as a Secret Service agent by the name of William Smith from Rochester, where it turns out the CIA has a secret photo lab called Hawkeye Works adjacent to Kodak headquarters. So that's when the transference, the switch was made. They took out the limousine stop. There wasn't enough time for Clint Hill. They took out Clint Hill, even though he has consistently reported his actions that day for more than 50 years now. They covered up the massive blow at the back of the head by painting it over. And there's now a group of Hollywood film restoration experts in coordination with a woman by the name of Sydney Wilkerson, who has been studying what's known as the forensic copy of the Zapruder film obtained directly from the National Archives. I've been into their lab. I've seen the film they're working with. The clarity of the film is simply as breathtaking. And what they've all observed is that the blowout at the back of the head was painted over in the film, and indeed very crudely, where I independently discovered before the publication of the 2003 Great Zapruder Film Hoax book that in frame 374, you could actually see the blowout. Now, in the meanwhile, and very early on, a fellow who's the leading expert on the medical evidence in the world, David W. Mantic, who has both a PhD in physics and an MD and is board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy. So he's an expert on the interpretation of X-rays. He'd gone into the National Archives. He's now gone in there, I don't know, 9 or 10 times and done a meticulous study of the autopsy X-rays and discovered using a technique from physics known as optical densitometry that at the back of JFK's skull, when you study the lateral cranial X-ray from the right side, in other words, the X-ray of his skull taken from the right side, that there's an area that he calls Area P for patch that was created by the exposure of some material much too dense to be human bone. And would you believe, when you compare his Area P with my subsequent discover of frame 374, where you can see the blowout, there's a very close match. They look both like a cashew on its side. I mean, it's really quite stunning how much we know about this now, and where, you know, Josiah Thompson doesn't have a leg to stand on. We not only know where it was altered and by whom it was altered, we know the major alterations, several of which I've already described. And if you compare, you know, the Zapruder with another film taken in Dealey Plaza there, probably the second most important, known as the Nix film, they're not even mutually consistent, because in the Nix film, Clint Hill goes further up on the trunk and Jackie further back than you see in the Zapruder. So the man has no leg to stand on. I'm very embarrassed to say that he betrayed philosophy and the JFK research community and has been acting to cover it all up. I published an article about him entitled JFK, the CIA, and the New York Times, because as we were approaching the 50th, a very famous film director was beginning to broadcast short takes, interviews with Josiah Thompson, which it was obvious to me were going to lead up to his repudiation of conspiracy on the occasion of the 50th observance. But I nailed him so hard for, you know, misrepresentation in this particular article that they abandoned the project. They only showed the one version. But when you associate with the New York Times or this high-quality producer, if someone hadn't called them on what Josiah Thompson was saying, they would got away with a huge propaganda bonanza.
Well, good for you, Jim, because, again, we're talking about this cult of debunking, you know, that 50th anniversary. You know, let me just put on the record for everybody listening. Contrary to Peter Jennings, ABC, Disney, and whoever else, the Presidential House Committee on Assassinations in 1976, I believe, determined officially, for the record, that there was another shooter. I believe it was based on sonic evidence.
Yeah, it was on...
And therefore, by definition, there was a conspiracy, everyone. So we don't, you know, this whole 50th anniversary revival where they tried to sidestep that whole point and take us back to the Warren Commission was just unbelievable.
Yeah, but you won't believe this, Fratter. In the National Archives, there's an unsigned note that says, in relation to the HSCA file, that the acoustical evidence has now been discounted, and therefore the position of the HSCA is the same as that of the Warren Commission, incredible as that sounds. But let me just point out one.
I had no idea.
That's amazing. Almost nobody knows this, but let me tell you something stunning. So we had all these witnesses, the physicians at Parkland Hospital, many witnesses, Dealey Plaza and elsewhere, describing this fist-sized hole at the back of the head. You even have a description of it in a book entitled The Kennedy Detail that includes a quote, you know, from Clint Hill about this fist-sized hole at the back of his head. That's actually in the book. But at Bethesda, would you believe, when they brought JFK's body in, and you probably are unaware, but it was secretly offloaded from Air Force One at Andrews Air Force Base, transferred to a helicopter and flown to Walter Reed, where the best forensic pathologists in the military were there to remove the bullet fragments, and it was put in a body bag inside a pinkish-gray shipping casket and sent in a black hearse over to the back of Bethesda Hospital, where it was offloaded. So the body was already on the autopsy table in the morgue undergoing dissection when Gerald Custer, who was the x-ray tech who actually took the x-rays at JFK, was headed upstairs, looked out in the company of two Secret Service men, looked out the window and saw the gray Navy ambulance and the official entourage with Jackie Kennedy coming up the steps to Bethesda Hospital, and said to himself, "What in the world is going on here?" Because the body was already in the morgue. I mean, now get this, and this is going to shock you, and almost no one knows this, but Doug Horn was able to uncover it when the Assassination Records Review Board did all of their work. They deposed the mortician, Thomas Evan Robinson, who had prepared the body for burial. He had spent more time with the body than anyone else in the history of the assassination. And he was shown a diagram by J. Thornton Boswell, who'd been assisting Commander James Humes in conducting the autopsy. Now, oddly enough, neither of these guys had ever performed an autopsy on a gunshot victim before, and they were chosen, I think, specifically for that reason, and because they were both very docile and manageable. But Thomas Evan Robinson and Ed Reed, who was a technician at Bethesda Hospital, were sitting there watching Commander Humes, who was in charge of the autopsy, take a cranial saw to the skull of JFK and enlarge the wound of the skull to make it look more like the effect of a shot from behind. So that David Lifton, when he looked at the description of the wound in the autopsy, official autopsy report, which I published as an appendix in Assassination Science, he read it to a physician of considerable competence, and just without identifying the subject. And what does that, he said, "What does that sound like to you?" And he said it sounded as though he'd been hit in the head with an axe, because it's just an enormous opening. Now, when we get to the HSCA, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, it's absolutely stunning because they contract both of those wounds. They don't agree with either Parkland or Bethesda. They contract it to a small wound right at the top of the head, right at the crown of the head, as an entry wound. And you can see with the where they claim the entry was made, which was actually 4 inches higher than they had originally been concluded at Bethesda. They had it much lower in the vicinity of the external occipital protuberance, which is the bump on the back of your head where you'd rest your head if you were reclining in a bathtub. They move it right to the top, to the crown of the head. It's as though they were trying to redo it the way they think it should have been done if it had been done properly in the beginning to cover it up. So you have this fist-sized hole at Parkland. You have this much larger wound, and I liken the fist size to the much larger wound as relatively the heel to a footprint, because it's that much bigger. And then they contracted the HSCA to this tiny wound at the top of the head. It's completely outrageous. One of the most well-known critics of the Warren Commission is Dr. Cyril Wecht. He's been the MD for Allegheny County for years. He may or may not be retired now. But Cyril Wecht was on the medical panel for the HSCA. He spent a lot of time, you know, ridiculing the magic bullet theory, which is perfectly appropriate. I actually went to Cambridge, gave a talk about the magic bullet theory, had it published in an international peer-reviewed journal, because once you know that the bullet didn't even hit JFK at the back of the neck, it actually was 5.5 inches lower in his back, just to the right of the spinal column, a shallow shot that didn't go anywhere. And we have the shirt and the jacket and the autopsy diagram and FBI sketch, the president's personal physician's death certificate, even reenactment photographs by the Warren Commission showing a wound at that location. You realize the magic bullet theory is ridiculous. In fact, David Manick, whom I already mentioned, has demonstrated it's not even anatomically possible because cervical vertebrae intervene. He took a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions, created a CAT scan, and plotted the official trajectory to discover that cervical vertebrae intervene. But the fact of the matter is, I was so troubled when I realized, and it took a while for this to sink in, the enormous difference between the official autopsy report with this massive hole in the back of the head and the very small wound at the top of the head that I called Cyril, whom I know personally, and said, Cyril, I said, how did the HSCA medical panel account for the discrepancy between the massive wound at the back of the head and this very small wound at the crown of the head in its own report? And Cyril said to me, I'll have to check my notes.
It's just Orwellian. It's unbelievable. It's like the whole, you know, just changing history as it's happening. And then looking back on things from decades before, we can just change the findings now, right? We can, you know, have a little review of it, just all the findings, and then everyone will believe that the news story is the way it's always been, right?
You got it, Fred. We're blowing these apart so thoroughly, you know. I mean, what are they going to say about our finding of the script for the Sandy Hook hoax?
Let's shift gears.
The Hollywood director has identified one of the key players as an actor he'd cast in his own film, and what was going on there is hyper-realistic filming. It was a staged event.
Well, I think it's important, too, because what it does, that's a specific example I wanted to make. What it does is it creates this ongoing cognitive dissonance amongst the viewers and the consumers, the ones out there who are trying to navigate through these murky waters of uncertainty and contradiction and just blatant misinformation and disinformation, so that when events occur, like, for example, I wanted to shift gears towards the emphasis on a recent article you published with regards to the Hobby Lobby controversy. And the reason I wanted to bring this up, and I wanted to give Materex a chance to talk to you about it too, was because it's an example of an event, a current event, that without proper scrutiny, without critical thinking, like you have mentioned, is key to use to process these events. Without critical thinking in the right place, with instead cognitive dissonance and uncertainty as your guide, you can't properly understand the implications and the connotations of what's being presented to you in the media. Well, and that, let's relate it right to that specific article.
Yeah, I'm real pleased you bring it up because I mean, here you had the most Americans don't even realize, but we have 9 justices of the Supreme Court. 6 of them are Roman Catholics. 3 of them are Jews. There isn't even a Protestant in the crowd, much less an atheist or an agnostic. I mean,
or a
Buddhist or a Confucian or a Muslim, for that matter. I mean, this is about as unrepresentative as it could possibly be. And it was 5 of the justices who sided with Hobby Lobby that they not be required to provide contraceptive coverage to their women employees, which is a complete absurdity. It violates and undermines a national health care mandate. They're now going to be besieged with special appeals from all kinds of special interest group that claim they should have their right to their religious preferences. And this has nothing to do with freedom of religion, by the way. Freedom of religion is best understood as freedom from religion, meaning that you can't be forced or coerced into specific beliefs or, in this case, actions in accordance with them. It's a completely outrageous decision. I am 100% opposed to it. And the article to which you refer is entitled Hobby Lobby, Can Philosophy Contribute to Solving Social Problems? Mater.
Yes. I just have so many feelings and thoughts about this in particular subject because I consider myself pro-choice because I don't think that anyone should have any say over what a woman or a man or whatnot, but in the realm of reproduction, what a woman does with her own body. And I think that it's inhumane to force an unwanted person to come into this world. And I say that as a mother of a person, and I love my children, and I would never have imagined my life being any fuller than it is right now with my children. But I don't think that it should be a political issue, for one thing. I think that if anyone doesn't believe in abortion or support abortion, that, you know, they just simply shouldn't have an abortion. And it shouldn't be the divisive issue that it is right now. And I really think that the Hobby Lobby guys in particular are very hypocritical in the sense that they are still investing through their 401ks in the very companies that make the very contraceptives and IUDs and Plan B things that they don't want to be forced to provide for their female employees, while they'll still cover Viagra and stuff like that.
You got it right. Not only that, but many of their products are made in China, which, of course, has the most draconian abortion policies of any nation in the world.
Right.
So that's another illustration of their hypocrisy. But where, you know, many Americans don't understand, they think that the pro-life position is the moral position. But morality entails treating other persons with respect, you know, that they have the right to make their own decisions and choices in life. And what goes on here is the attempt to impose one group's preferences on another group that does not share them. In fact, we know that slavery is immoral, if any practice is immoral, and yet the pro-life position would require women to carry unwanted pregnancies to term, turning them into reproductive slaves. It's a gross form of immorality. It's also anti-democratic because, I mean, what can be more democratic than choice, you know, having the right to decide for yourself whether you're going to have a family, how many children you're going to have, the circumstances under which you will have them, and so forth. And I even add it's un-American because it's so completely contrary to traditional American values. I say, therefore, that, you know, the pro-life position is immoral, undemocratic, and anti-American, and I elaborate on those themes in that article.
And so often, hypocritically pro-war. You know,
I was just about to say how Bill Hicks, in one of his comedic performances, had made a comment about pro-lifers and how he was basically saying how I really just can't take pro-lifers seriously until they start protesting funerals. And I mean, I would take it one step further to as Freda just said, war. I don't see any of these people speaking so heavily against the murder of children in other countries right now.
Well, Mater, what could be more obvious than that sex education and birth control reduces unwanted pregnancies and therefore reduces abortion? So these people, if they were sincere in their desire to reduce abortion, ought to be promoting birth control and sex education, not opposing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And exactly. You know, to add to that, I just recently read an article about something someone had posted, I believe it was on Facebook, about sex education in schools. And as a parent, I believe that we have a responsibility to share those things with our children. But I also am a working class person who doesn't have a lot of time to sit down with and delve into certain subjects with my kids. Now, I'm personally taking the mantle of being the person who provides them with that information. But I understand putting that into the curriculum at schools. I don't necessarily believe that they need to start in elementary school, let alone kindergarten, or something I'd seen about these stuffed sex toys for toddler age children to learn about sex. I'm scared to go there.
Yeah, it's pretty freaky.
Anatomically correct.
Yes. It's just freaky.
They had a picture of these two little, you know, they could have been stuffed animals, felt, you know, fuzzy little things that were just like, you know, men and women genitalia. And they didn't take too much time on that one. But I thought, God, a 3-year-old doesn't really have the capacity to even understand what you're telling them in that moment. They're living in the universe world, you know, where they're, everything is a wonder to them. And now you're going to,
I mean, I think this kind
of their intentions on that.
education is most appropriate at junior high school level when puberty is taking place, and there's an immense interest in sex, and you can teach kids, you know, the elements of reproduction and sex education and how to take safeguards against unwanted pregnancy.
Right.
Totally appropriate in that way, and that's the way we completely agree with you. And it's just another example, though, of how we're being shepherded as a society and what we're being expected to accept, just you know, wholesale, whole cloth. We're being expected to accept absurdities and completely, you know, actions devoid of the basic moral compass that we all experience. The things you mentioned about democracy, about the American way, and you know, I know we've violated our own principles in many ways, policies, and especially globally and foreign policies, you know, in those ways. But I also know that I know plenty of people in my life and my experience that are guided by these same principles you mentioned. You know, and this is the very, very foundation. We talked a little while ago about gun control, about Eric Holder and about Obama's words against gun possession in the wake of violent media episodes. But gun control issue is so important an issue, I think, in the sense that we have to see that the possession of the gun is one of the last remnants of the revolution. It is the way in which humanity fought off tyranny, everyone. To give up the guns is to allow tyranny back into our existence.
You're absolutely right, Frater. I mean, listen, I think all that stands between DHS and, you know, turning this into a complete fascistic police state is 100 million armed Americans. This is why they're so concerned about it. And you fail to appreciate that. What if the government were to collapse? What if there were to be a nuclear bombing and we no longer had a government? How would the American people restore some semblance of law and order? Or, you know, I mean, we can envision a Jericho scenario. Where would the residents of Jericho have been had they been without any weapons whatsoever? I mean, what happens if a motorcycle gang comes into a town and terrorizes it if the residents there don't have any weapons, or someone breaks into your house, ties you up, murders your wife, rapes your daughter? If you had weapons, you might have been able to do something about it. They find that in communities where there's even a requirement that every home should have a gun, that the crime rate drops precipitously. And it's just obvious common sense. In fact, there was a semi-facetious effort to go home to home to ask if it would be all right to put a sign on the front of the residence saying, "This is a gun-free zone." No one wanted to do it because, of course, it's an invitation for burglary or robbery or what have you. Remember, the reason we call police is because police have weapons. Well, if we have and it takes time for them to arrive at the scene. Well, if we already have weapons, we can deal with it. We know that citizens in self-defense, you know, the use of a weapon, it can be perfectly appropriate, just as soldiers in combat. And, you know, the whole debate about guns has spun wildly out of control. We need them. They're as American as apple pie. Where would the Patriots have been without them at Lexington and Valley Forge? I mean, listen, face it. We need guns. They're part of the American way. And I say when they come for our guns, the time has come to use them.
Well, yeah. Look at Katrina, for example, too. I mean, if the government officials deem an area, you know, oh, hands off or hopeless or we're just going to wait it out, the people inside that area are left to their own to fend for themselves. You know, when you said like some sort of a grid failure or any kind of communications failure, natural disaster or otherwise nuclear assault, any of these things would break down the lines of communication and hierarchy in governments immediately.
Right, and I never got to the point talking about what if the government is a tyrannical government, which unfortunately appears to be what we have today. I envision something like the French Revolution of rising up against, you know, the rich and powerful who have been abrogating everything to themselves, depriving the American people of living wages, offshoring their corporate headquarters to evade taxes. We're in a terrible way. The United States is sinking into third world status, and it all appears to be a deliberate plan where Henry Kissinger, once again, may be playing a key role because there are reports that he has been advocating you know, decimating the United States of about 80% of its population, and what's going on with our food supply and our water supply, where Nestle, of all things, an international company, is draining Lake Superior of water to sell it commercially. I mean, this is outrageous.
Not just that, but I actually just read an article recently about them not necessarily stealing, but taking water from this reservoir and underground well that is sitting underneath an Indian reservation.
Yeah, well, there's no
and bottling it up to sell to us.
That would fit the pattern, Mater. It would fit the pattern perfectly. I mean, this kind of exploitation of natural resources for a profit motive. You know, there was a dictum by Milton Friedman, who was an economist at the University of Chicago, who said that the only social obligation of corporations is to maximize profits for their stockholders. But what that means, if you want to maximize profits, you want to minimize the cost of labor, pay the lowest wages and the fewest benefits possible. You want to exploit natural resources, not clean up pollution. Steal the natural resources if you can. You can't get it any cheaper than that. Evade taxes, move your headquarters offshore, create monopolies, because monopolies can promote profits. We have not had free markets in the United States for at least 100 years. I mean, it's completely ridiculous for the ideologues to claim this is a great country because we have free markets. Adam Smith identified 5 different features that are necessary to have free markets, and the United States today exemplifies none of them.
Well, okay, now, Professor James H. Fetzer, you know, we're rounding up to the end of this conversation, and in a deliberate attempt to end on a high note and on a positive, let me ask you, though, what do you think, what is your message to the listeners, the best way to move forward armed with the knowledge that it's all designed to blow our minds and that we're deliberately being misled on a wholesale level, on a daily level, by the ones we're supposed to trust?
Well, learn all you can about these events. If you go to my veteranstoday.com/author/Fetzer/, you can read all about 9/11, JFK, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, and share that with your neighbors. If you can get them to have an open mind, finding, you know, the script for Sandy Hook might be a nice way to open a conversation, but don't expect anyone's going to welcome what you have to say. Mark Twain observed that it's easier to deceive a man than it is to get him to admit that he's been fooled. On the other hand, I say, stock up on guns and ammunition and food supplies. You should have a stock on hand for at least several weeks, if not a month. If you don't know how to shoot, learn to shoot, because there's no telling what the future holds that may require you be able to defend yourself and your family and loved ones.
Indeed.
That's excellent, excellent words. And, you know, just to the final word on this conversation, because we began it with the subject of the Apollo mission and the idea of the book that our good friend David McGowan, who we're going to bring on next week to talk about the Wagging the Moon Doggy, the one most compelling bit of evidence that has stared me in the face my whole life, and I never seemed to really grasp the implications of it until I reviewed the material in Wagging the Moon Doggy. And that is, of course, the famous slingshot theory of how we actually escaped the Earth's gravitational pull and then sort of just free fall to the moon, and how we're expected to believe this. I don't know if you have any words about this, but well, I wanted to put out, Jim, just for the listeners, I wanted to say to them, you know, this is the just to read it a little bit right out of the book. This is what sounds like a fine theory up front until you take a step back and realize that the moon itself is a satellite of the Earth, held in place by, you guessed it, the Earth's gravitational attraction. Isn't that, after all, what keeps it from drifting randomly about the universe?
Well,
the solar
absolutely,
system?
As Sir Isaac Newton established, and by the way, may I say, what most Americans have found most persuasive have been the moon rocks. What they're unaware of is that Wernher von Braun led an expedition to the Antarctic to collect moon rocks because they're broken free of the moon's gravitational field by asteroids, small asteroids hitting the Earth, captured in Earth's gravity and brought down to Earth in the Antarctic, so that they could produce moon rocks that actually would test out as bona fide moon rocks, only they had not been brought back by astronauts from the moon.
How very and so, convenient that suit yeah. that is.
But you see, the point that's being made here is those moon rocks even made it back to Earth. Not they didn't work, they didn't stay on the moon. And you know, when you think about this, is the other great point here. There was an article that was just out recently on the internet, well, in the last few years, that talked about GPS device satellites and how they're at an altitude of roughly 12,000 miles. Okay, so that's 11,800 miles above the low Earth orbit that all the other space vehicles we put into space go to. So the question remains, it is miraculous, is it not, that none of these satellites have fallen out of orbit and landed on the moon, even though we're expected to believe that at about 250 miles up, the lunar capsule was sent into a slingshot and then free fell to the moon.
Prater, you're going to have a wonderful conversation with Dave McGowan. I think very highly of him. He's fascinating on a wide range of topics, and Wagging the Moon Doggy is among the best. Congratulations for getting him. I look forward to your show next week with Dave McGowan.
Well, Professor James H. Fetzer, I really want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an amazing ride with you. And I know the listeners are going to enjoy this conversation because, you know, it was just it's kind of the shotgun method. We just sort of blasted everything against the wall and see what sticks, you know. But in the end, we really covered a lot of ground in a short time. And I want to thank you again, and I want to point everybody towards your podcast, which is The Real Deal with Jim Fetzer over at Revere Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, 5 p.m. Central Standard Time, correct?
Yeah, radiofetzer.blogspot.com is the archive of some 800 shows now. You can take your pick.
Wow. All right. Well, again, thank you, Jim Fetzer, for joining us here in the Middle Chamber. And as you've already pointed out, we are so looking forward to next week's conversation with Dave McGowan, the author of the new Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, and, of course, the older book, Wagging the Moon Doggy. Thanks again, Jim, for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's
real
been great talking
good.
To you.
Thanks. Thanks, Mater. Thanks, Frater.
Farewell and have a great weekend.
You got it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, everybody. I hope you enjoyed listening. Thanks so much to Jim Fetzer. It was a great conversation. Please join us next week. We have an exciting conversation coming up with Dave McGowan on whatever may come across the pike.
Yeah, I mean, you can just imagine what it's going to be like next week, because we're going to cover a lot of the same material, and we're going to be talking to the author of the book, Wagging the Moon Doggy, which, by the way, we mentioned, you can find that online at his website, so just keyword search Wagging the Moon Doggy. So with that, yes, it's our final farewell, everyone. Thank you for staying tuned to us, and please keep coming back and join us in the chat, and say goodnight, Mater X.
Good night, Mater X.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.